Two things immediately came to mind about being a better storyteller, teaching yourself how to be a better storyteller. One is to become a student of humanity, whether it's through history or philosophy, trying to learn as much as you can about humanity and the human experience so that you start to see patterns emerge and you start to have an understanding for who we are and why we do what we do. And that starts to get at some really deep truths so that when you're telling your stories, you start to tap into something that is essentially human.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker, National Geographic explorer, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. This week on the show, my guest is Kat Zidane, who is a self-described story nerd. Kat studied theater at UCSB and got her MFA in ensemble-based physical theater from Del Arte International School of Physical Theater. Kat has been performing, teaching, and directing professionally in the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond since 2009. And not only does Kat work in scripted theater, she is also a member of Improv Playhouse, one of the top improv troupes in the Bay Area. Off the stage, Kat uses her amazing sense of narrative, character, and dialogue as a conversation designer at Xandra. Xandra is a company which brings artists and engineers, developers together to create interactive voice experiences for technology like Amazon Alexa and Google Home. And if you're confused about what a conversation designer is or what all that's about, don't worry. We dig into it in this show. In this episode, Kat and I discuss the story techniques that she has learned working in play development, what elements create memorable and compelling characters, and then how she's leveraging both her creative mind and her more logic-based mind to tell stories with emerging technology. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kat Zidane. Kat Zidane, thank you so much for joining the
My
Austin
pleasure.
Meyer Podcast. We are at your lovely studio here in Emeryville, and it's a beautiful space. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming over.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's not raining because there are a billion skylights.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very loud.
Yeah, I was actually telling my mom the other day, I'm editing a documentary right now, and there's this interview that I've been wanting to put over B-roll. These clips and the interview, I have it all scripted out on paper, and then I go to the editing system and I realize like the whole interview has just torrential downpour during it. But all the clips I wanted to put over, beautiful sunshine.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. Heartbreaking.
Yeah, heartbreaking. So when we were emailing before the show, you mentioned to me that you are a story nerd.
Yes.
I would love to hear why you consider yourself a story nerd, and have you always been a story nerd?
Yes. So, oh gosh, my whole life is flashing before my eyes. So, in short, yes, I always have been. When I was 4 years old, I begged my mom to let me get my own library card. Actually, when I was three, I really wanted my own library card. And my mom said, you know, Catherine, you can't get a library card until you can sign your name because you have to sign your name on it. And she said, and you're not going to learn how to sign your name until you go to kindergarten. But I begged and I begged and I begged. And she taught me how to write my name when I was four, so that I could get a library card.
Okay.
And just because I've always loved stories, I've always loved books. And it started when I was little as a love of reading. Mm. And I loved books, but I would also get cassette tapes and records of stories. So like pre-podcast, or I guess radio kinds of things then.
Yeah.
And I've just always, always loved escaping into other worlds. I'm definitely, as a reader and as a consumer of entertainment, definitely an escapist. Not like I even though I love learning, there are a lot of incredible nonfiction books, when I sit down to read, I always pick up fiction because I really just want to escape into some kind of story. So I started from as long as I can remember just loving books and reading and stories and fairy tales. And then very quickly, that turned into performance when I was young. As I've gotten older, that one of the things, like as a professional performer, as a professional actor, my specialty has been working on new play development in the way I'm assuming this works in every theater market, but especially in the Bay Area, there are ecosystems. So there's like the musical theater ecosystem, and kind of the same general pool of actors tends to get cast there. And then there's the like very serious plays ecosystem, and or there's the Shakespeare ecosystem, and sometimes you can hop between them. But I started off when I was starting my career here doing a little of everything, and I kind of settled into the ecosystem of new play development and world premieres. So that's
outside of all those other ecosystems that you just mentioned?
Well, they're kind of all intertwined. Okay. But because sometimes a new play could have music and be a musical.
Okay.
You're not going to have a new play. Well, you might have a new play that has Shakespeare as a topic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of overlap, and this is a overgeneralization as well. But I did tend to specialize in new plays, and I think it's because I've got a lot of creative and artistic training and tendencies, but I have a very logic and structure oriented brain, as you saw at my desk when you walked in. Hmm. And so, as an actor in a play that's in development, I'm able not only to give voice to the characters so that the playwright can hear what that sounds like, but also to kind of bring a dramaturgical brain to the structure of the play, to the development of the narrative, and to that kind of stuff. So I think that is how I ended up in that niche in particular.
Okay. So is play development, what does that entail?
That's a great question. So when a playwright is working on a play, they generally start it, you know, alone with the blank page at their computer. But the thing about plays, or screenplays or anything that is meant to be performed, is that you can kind of only get so far as a writer on your own before hearing it aloud. That's when you really start to learn, what is this thing that I've made? My current day job as a conversation designer, I'm essentially writing plays for like Alexa or Google Home, writing interactive plays that people hear out loud. And I will also attest that what you've written, even if you've worked on it and edited and all this stuff, once you get it into the hand of performers, you often go, oh, I could cut that. Oh, that has to move over here. Oh gosh, this is not what I thought it was. There's something that really, you just learn so much about what you've created when it's in the hands and in the mouths and in the bodies of the creators. Mm. And it just brings a whole other dimension to the work. So every playwright is different, but new play development all often goes as such. The playwright has their idea, their concept. They write a first draft. They, depending on their process, they might write many drafts before they get people, or they might write a first draft, reach out to a theater and say, hey, I'd like to do a reading of this. This is a first draft. Mm-hmm. Can we get a cast together? Hear it out loud. And my favorite playwrights will then hear it out loud, rework it, hear it out loud, rework it, and kind of tweak and everything with going back and forth between their own process and the collaborative process until they arrive at like the performance draft of the script.
And does the playwright cast particular people to be part of that reading, or is it kind of just random performers?
It really depends. If the playwright, I have working relationships with a lot of playwrights and friendships with playwrights, and so I often, if a playwright's like, hey, I'm just having some people over to my house to read this, come on over. Or a playwright often, if they're working with a theater to set up a reading, might say, I wrote this with XYZ actors in mind, or hey, I'd really love to hear this person. Or a playwright might not have any preference about actors. Maybe they're out of town, maybe they don't know local actors, in which case they'll rely on the casting director or the director or the artistic director of the theater they're working with to bring a cast together.
What's a common realization that a playwright has that you've experienced in those conversations after a reading has been done of their story.
Sure. Well, for me, when I'm writing, my number one realization is I overwrote this. I wrote too much. I can cut this. I can cut that. I can cut this. So a lot of edits come to light. Also, you find out if your jokes land or not. and
hard to tell that on the page. Huh?
Yeah. But more than that, and to come back to like being a story nerd, you really like, you start to learn about the structure of the narrative and have you structured it in a way, have you scaffolded the story in a way that serves the emotional arc? Does this scene need to get moved? Does this scene need to get cut altogether? Is there a missing link between these two scenes? Mm. A lot of the information about the structure of the story starts to become apparent. And I'm very, very lucky that a frequent collaborator of mine, who's also one of my closest friends, is a woman named Lauren Gunderson, who is the most produced playwright in America, or I think she still has a title. She had the title officially for a couple of years, but she's just a prolific playwright and is produced all over the place. And she is brilliant. And she teaches a class on playwriting that she calls play math. Hmm. Because she's, you know, talks about you have to figure out the structure. For her, she says you figure out the ending and you backwards engineer from that to get there.
Oh, interesting.
And so she has got this beautifully logically organized brain, but then also is, you know, just an amazing writer and a creative mind as well, but it's layered over her meticulous logic. And so I've always enjoyed, like, when there's a movie or a book, when I'm experiencing it the first time, I let myself just get swept up and totally enveloped in the world. But if it's particularly breathtaking, I often find myself wanting to go back and pick it apart and be like, how did they make that? Like, what were the pieces they put together to get to that emotional experience?
Yeah. So you mentioned that you have a very logical brain as well.
I do.
Do you approach the structure of what you write and craft in a similar way? And if not, how do you use your logical mind to write structure?
I absolutely approach from a very logical standpoint. And me being able to tell you, oh, I'm a very logically minded person, is actually brand new for me.
Oh.
I, for many years, told myself the story that, oh, I was so, you know, artsy, creative, great with language, and terrible at math. When I was in high school, my best subjects were I would have told you my best subjects were English and science.
Okay.
And my worst subjects were math and history. And I would have told you I'm terrible at math and history because they're with numbers and I can't remember numbers. They don't stick. I'm terrible at math. And that was the story I told myself of who I was and how my brain worked for a long time. And then I long story short, there was a day a couple of years ago and I said, made some offhand comment to my husband about how bad I was at math. And he said, okay, I really would like it if you would stop saying that because you're definitely not bad at math. And then I got this job in conversation design, which we can talk about. And I kind of had a moment of looking back over my life and realizing in high school, I would have told you that I was terrible at history and at math, but I had the same grade in those classes as I had in the other classes. I had A's in all of those classes. The house I grew up in burned down last year, and my brother had salvaged some boxes of my old schoolwork, and my mother had saved all of my report cards and standardized test results from elementary school. And I was going through those and I was shocked. Every year I was getting in the 99th percentile in language and math. And it never occurred to me that maybe that's because I was strong in both of those.
Right.
And I leaned so hard into the creative, you know, I got a BFA, I got an MFA, I've worked for over a decade as a creative. It never occurred to me that that other side of, and that I was equally strong in this other kind of, I mean, you only have one brain. So it's not like it's a different brain, but a different kind of thinking. There's the creative amorphous thinking, but then there's also the really structured logical thinking. And it's just recently that I've like looked back on my whole life and been like, it's been there the whole time. Like it's just always been a part. And when you're working as a teacher or a performer, what you're getting feedback on is the performance, is the creativity, is the imagination, is the lesson you're teaching. People don't often come over and say like, you know, the way you figured out how to learn your lines or the way you manage a classroom is really something. So yeah. I wasn't getting feedback on right. that part of what I was doing, but mm-hmm. it was always happening. Mm-hmm. I just happen to be in a job now where I am getting feedback on the structural side as well.
Gotcha. And so now that you have come to that realization that it is a skill of yours, how are you leveraging it to be a better storyteller?
That's such a good question. So I just yesterday, a skill for Alexa launched that I was the creative lead on.
So maybe before we get into that, we should talk about what it means to be, or like what an Alexa skill is for those who don't know.
Great. Yes. And,
yeah. Or conversation designer. Yeah.
So let's back this way up.
Yeah.
My day job is currently I am a conversation designer with a company called Xandra. We are a conversation design studio that makes fully immersive audio experiences. We are platform agnostic, but we do often end up making things for, say, Amazon Alexa or Google Home. And what a conversation designer does, what I do, is I figure out a way. I write a script for an experience that is interactive. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like writing a radio play that you can talk to.
Okay.
So I'm creating stories and characters that a user is going to either affect the outcomes of the story or interact with the characters directly.
Okay. So the characters in the story are all voices coming out of the Google Home or Alexa.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah. This could all, I mean, there's also applications in augmented reality or virtual reality where you're speaking to characters and they're speaking back to you. Anytime that something is interactive with audio and or characters, there's a conversation designer involved. And so, when I say the word Alexa skill, on the Alexa platform, what they call apps, they call them skills. So confusingly, in order to find an Alexa skill, you go into the Alexa app.
It's like, okay.
It gets very complicated very quickly. But there are different skills that you can enable on your Alexa device. So, for example, at Xandra, my company, they also, we've made a Westworld skill with HBO. We made a Esme and Roy skill with HBO and Sesame, which is an existing cartoon. We also have made a number of skills for Nickelodeon, so like a SpongeBob skill.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that could be like a kid is having a conversation with SpongeBob through the Alexa or something like that.
Yes. This SpongeBob skill is a game where the player is an employee at the Krusty Krab.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you have to, and all these crazy characters come in order and it's a memory game. You have to remember. So they make an order and then the narrator asks you to recall what the order was.
Okay.
But there's characters from the game from the cartoon in the game with you.
Mm-hmm.
So we make entertainment skills, but there are other skills you can enable. Like if you wanted a skill that was going to give you stock market information, you could enable that on your Alexa. And then you could say, Alexa, you know, tell me, you know, ask my stocks, what my stock portfolio is. So those are called skills in the Alexa environment. They're called actions on Google Home. They kind of have their own name in different environments. And if you are listening to this and you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's not you. It's like a brand new job. It's
yeah.
a brand new kind of industry. So it's super emergent. It's weird. Like not many people, it's not you, it's us.
Mm-hmm. So you're designing the conversations that people are interacting with.
Correct.
And getting back to before we kind of gave the background about your logical brain creating stories, or how you're using that your logic skills to create stories in that environment. How would you say you do that?
Sure. So now I'm going to actually go back one step in order to come forward.
I love it.
So my first job as a conversation designer was at a company called Pullstring. And the people who founded Pullstring were all alums of Pixar. And we're actually like one block away from Pixar. So, and they started a company called Toy Talk, which turned into this company, Pullstring. And the legacy of Pixar that they brought with them to Pullstring was that artists and engineers work side by side to execute a common artistic vision. So their entire creative team, they had a huge creative team for their pro services team that were conversation designers. And a lot of them were actors. And we had screenwriters and actors and children's book authors and just kind of a diverse background, but with artistic backgrounds, not with engineering backgrounds. And so when I was hired to be a conversation designer for chatbots, which I had no idea what a chatbot was. I had never really heard about them. I thought what I was going to be doing was waltzing in and kind of doing Mad Libs, like just using my creative juices to like fill in blanks for conversations that existed.
Right.
And then I was hired, and then I had a training week. And what I learned how to do in that week was essentially how to program, because the conversation designers are not filling in blanks. They are creating the structure of what this conversation is going to be. So if you think about somebody comes to you and says, hey, I want you to make a voice experience for someone to buy groceries. Mm-hmm. Okay. The way you would structure that interaction is very different than if somebody said, hey, I want you to make an open world game where somebody gets to talk to the characters.
Okay.
Both of them involve conversation design. Both of them are interactive and conversational, but the goal of the conversation is very different. The structure of the interaction is going to be very different. One is transactional, whereas one is either narrative or just exploratory. So the logic and the rigging and the programming to create the engine or that you use for the engine to create the conversation is going to look totally different. So it's kind of like a caprese salad essentially has the same ingredients as a pizza,
mm-hmm.
but they taste and look very different. And the processes to arrive at them are very different.
Nice metaphor.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I had to learn not only how to write for interactive conversations and things like how to script a good prompt so that when you're prompting the user, they understand how to answer you. But I also had to learn how to organize the logic of the conversation to make a successful conversation. So for example, if it was a really simple ask and they said, I just want a conversational agent so that someone can order a pair of shoes with their smart speaker.
Right.
It would be a bad design if the first thing that the first prompt was like, how are you feeling today? Because that is such a broad open question that it would be very difficult to program for it. But also, how do you pivot from that into the shoe exchange? So figuring out the very fundamental things of like, what's your opening line? Like it might be, hi, I'm here to help you order a pair of shoes. Can we start by telling you, let's start by having you tell me your shoe size. That's a terrible example of a line. don't think that is a good prompt, but just in terms of thinking how to onboard a user into an experience, how to set them up for success, how to put it on rails so that you're not asking open-ended questions if you don't want open-ended answers.
Mm-hmm. And sorry.
Go ahead.
Jump in. And for some of these examples, I'm wondering, what's the connection between a conversation and a story? Because I could totally see the shoe example is just like, what shoe do you want to buy? And like, I want that that shoe? And you're like, great, it's ordered. Like, why is it important to make these skills into stories? And what's the connection between conversation and story?
Right. So not every skill should be a story. Like the shoe one, I mean, I guess you could argue that everything's a story and it's the story of you finding your perfect pair of shoes. But in terms of the narrative, because we have done just pure user experience skills, but we really love doing narrative or character projects, driven skills and stories. And those are different. So if you think about what, I wish I remembered the person who first came up with this so I could attribute it correctly, but a story is a technology, is a piece of technology that humans utilize to share knowledge and experience. So, a story is a way to communicate with one another, not just facts, but also experiences and emotion and feelings and growth and wisdom and all these things. So why you might want to make a narrative experience with a story arc as a skill or as a conversational interaction is it could be for any number of reasons. It could be to excite someone about a particular existing brand, like the skill I just did for a video game for Tom Clancy's The Division 2. The purpose of the skill was to bridge the narrative gap between the two games and for like a call to action for people to play the new game. It also might just be that there's a particularly beloved character like SpongeBob or a particularly beloved piece of IP like Westworld, where what users want is just the opportunity to interact with that world more and beyond just the TV show or the movie. They want a chance to live in the world, talk to the characters, be a part of the world. It also might be educational or for the purposes of building empathy for, you know, like maybe acquainting your audience with a type of person that they may not be. I mean, there are as many reasons why you might want to make a narrative skill as there are reasons you might want to write a novel or make a TV show or a movie. We did an interesting skill last summer at a hackathon. We were at a hackathon at the Cannes Lions Festival, and it was sponsored by Amazon and Huge and Global Citizen. And the hackathon was called Change for Good, and the prompt was to create a skill that would positively impact the, lives of people who need a hand. And so we decided what our skill did was told stories of girls in different parts of the world and made it was kind of like an interactive narrative podcast, and you could make decisions about should she do A or B. And depending on the branching narrative, you got to learn what her outcomes would be and how different those were from somebody who had different opportunities than her. And at the end of the skill, you had the opportunity to tweet about that cause and also to open a pipeline for making donations to that cause. So that one, the whole reason to make it a story and to make it immersive and to really bring the user along was to bring that world to life and to have the user really identify with the people that we were hoping they would try to help.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
I'd love to dive deep into character with you and how to create compelling characters for stories, or what makes compelling characters in stories. And I'd love to start that by, I find it interesting, you have your acting background and then now it's conversation design. When I think of acting, you know, so much of how characters are created are the facial expressions. It's the body language. It's that stuff that you now don't have access to just working in the audio format. So maybe thinking about how you develop characters, how has your experience in either acting or the conversation design influenced how you create characters in the other medium?
What a good question. What I am immediately thinking of is one of the things about audio design that is interesting is that it's in many ways, it's very intimate, especially because a lot of us listen to our devices on headphones. So it's just us and the voices. I think about podcast hosts or musicians whose voices I got to know before I ever knew what they looked like, and how interesting that is when you've listened to somebody and you've kind of decided who they are and what they look like, and then you see a picture or see an interview with them and it's completely jarring. It's similar to when you've read a book and you've fallen in love with the character and then they make a movie of it and you're like, well, that's not what she looks like. They got it totally wrong. And what's really great about what I'm doing is there is no visual representation. There is only the voice and the words I have chosen and the sound design that our audio engineer and sound designer does, and then the imagination of the listener. Another thing I thought about was there are, instead of facial expressions and body language, there are a lot of acting choices that you can make with just your voice, or maybe not acting choices, maybe just, being a person, human choices. A lot of them we don't know in the moment that we're making. For example, right now I am speaking at a relatively low volume in kind of what I would call a soothing version of my voice. and for the most part, choosing my words pretty carefully. Mm-hmm. However, if I was talking like this and I had a different tone of voice and maybe, I don't know, I was just going a little faster off the cuff, you, the listener, would have a very different impression of who I was as a person, what my character is.
Yeah.
So there are so many subtle ways you can manipulate a voice performance to point at the same kind of things that facial expression and body language get. And I'm going to come to something really interesting about this too. But some examples of that would be how close and how quietly you're speaking. If you're like asking the user to lean in, and the kind of emotional state that sets, like, are you talking to the user from far away and giving them directions, or are you really trying to get to know them and have a tender moment? Also, word choice, vocal tics, accent, dialect, pauses. I mean, there's just so many ways to insinuate character into words. What's interesting about this, I'm realizing as we talk, is that my particular specialty in theater is that I have an MFA in physical theater, specifically. So, and that is my specialty as a performer too, is I can do these kind of big physical transformations and highly physical performances and physical specificity, but I can also do things like mask and clown and all these very physical forms and
things like mask and clown. Those aren't necessarily without dialogue, right? Or are they?
They could be. Yeah.
Yeah. But often
there is no speaking.
Oh, okay.
But what's interesting is that I think there's a thread line. There's a through line that connects, for example, me performing in a mask and having no words to me. I just, for this last skill, I had to write an action sequence that had no visuals, which is a trip. Like, I was trying to think, oh my goodness, how do I communicate all of this plot without having, the film devices such as an establishing shot or, jump cuts or all these things to help evoke not only a feeling, but also let the user know what the heck, let the viewer, the listener know what's going on. But the through line between a silent performance with a mask and then an audio only action sequence is understanding the essentialization of the form, understanding the limitations of the form in a way that allows you to work within them. This comes back to structure, understanding what fundamentally you are trying to communicate and looking within the limitations to say, how can I communicate that in this form? So I think what I have like made a career of being adept at doing is recognizing limitations, understanding essentialization, and communicating within those parameters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, it sounds like not only recognizing the limitations, but also the things that make it really powerful. Like you were talking about that intimacy that comes with audio.
Yeah.
So you can do that little lean in, mm-hmm. which is a little bit harder to do maybe when you're on stage in front of a massive theater.
Absolutely. And there's certain things, like one of the funny things about acting on stage in particular is that even when you're doing a really intimate love scene, you essentially have to be shouting in each other's faces because there are technical limitations to theater. The people in the back row have to be able to hear you as well as the people in the front row. And even the people in the front row might be 30 feet away from you.
Right.
So you have to create this illusion of intimacy with your scene partner, even though you are broadcasting it in the least intimate setting imaginable.
Yeah.
Whereas in film or television, it's the opposite. You can be tiny and small and subtle because the camera will come to you. You don't have to project yourself into the millions of homes.
Yeah. I was actually an extra in a movie last year, and I was in a scene in which Steve Carell and I forget the actress he was working with, but I was walking around a gallery. I was like one of the gallery patrons, mm-hmm. and they started shooting the scene, and because like I come from like improv theater as a background, when they were doing their lines, I thought they were just, I didn't think we were actually rolling because they were speaking so quietly. I was stunned. Yeah. I was like, oh, that was a take.
Yeah, because they have their little lav mics and it's really such a different thing. And they don't, and like but there's also technical things that film actors are doing, such as hitting their marks, staying open to the camera. Like, acting is so weird because everybody tells you it has to be natural, it has to be real, it has to be natural. But there's nothing real or natural about the circumstances. Think about, like, so you have the weird thing about an intimate scene on the stage, which is where you're shouting in each other's faces. But a sex scene in a movie is equally as weird because here you are trying to have an intimate moment with a person that you may or may not feel like having an intimate moment with,
yeah.
and with Lord knows how many people standing around watching you. Like, it's weird. It's so weird.
Yeah.
And all of it is manufactured. All of it is, if it's done artfully, it doesn't feel manufactured. It feels effortless. It feels real. It feels authentic. But all of these are just and it's all an example of someone who is adept at crafting an experience within the limitations of the stage or the screen. Mm. Something I thought about also because you were asking about writing characters.
Yeah.
So for this video game skill, for this one for The Division, I had to figure out, first of all, how would this story work? Like, who is this main character? Why are they taking audio recordings? And then, why are they putting them, like, how has this gotten to an Alexa? Why does this make any sense?
Right. So some sort of motivations.
Yes.
They're making some audio recording for a reason.
Yeah. So for me, I started coming up with, like, what are the problems? Like, what are the things that just don't make sense? Like, yeah, why are they taking audio recordings and why is this ultimately happening on an Alexa? Mm-hmm. So, and I identified all those problems with Post-its. And then I thought, okay, well, why might somebody make audio recordings? It's kind of a trope in spy or mystery stuff where, you know, the detective is talking to themselves. It's a way to document what's happening. And because it's this video game world and it's this narrative, and because I'm teasing at greater mysteries in the video game, so I thought, okay, it's someone who's highly intelligent, really dedicated, has a feeling that something is not quite right. And so then the justification I came up with was for why is it on an Alexa and why is a user talking to it, was that I decided that this agent Agent X is the character's name. This agent was on the ground in DC. Things weren't quite adding up. They didn't know who to trust. So they started making these audio recordings, and they wanted it. They wanted to get it to an agent waiting deployment outside of DC. So they hacked it into the Alexa environment.
Oh, nice.
To get it to somebody who could listen. And the whole premise is, and I ended up casting a woman in the role. So she says, I need your help. Maybe you can figure something out from these recordings that I can't. And so by identifying what the problems are and coming up with what those solutions are, a kind of person who might do this began to arise for me of who is this? Who is this woman? And then on top of that, I thought, who am I interested in hearing from in this kind of post-apocalyptic, militaristic world? Who do I want to hear from? And so she ended up, she's this really smart, intuitive woman, but who's in a very rigid, militaristic world and being told like not to necessarily trust her emotions or her instincts. And so, yeah, she just emerged from kind of the problem solving. And then she also emerged, I'm sure, from the, you know, zillions of stories that I've read and movies that I've watched. And so this like badass, strong woman, who is, you know, doing her best. And then when I was in the, I was directing the actor, Tristan Cunningham, who is one of my favorite actors. She is phenomenal, who I cast in the role. When I was directing her in the booth and I was giving her notes about different lines, I found myself saying things that I had not thought about when I was writing the script, but I was saying, you know, you're, because the background for the, oh, the other thing, the background for the character, as I thought, how on earth would this person be able to hack this stuff into the Alexa environment? What kind of a job would they have had to be able to do this? So they were a securities engineer in their civilian life. And so I was giving the actor notes. I was saying, you know, you were this securities engineer. That's a largely male-dominated space. Now you're this militaristic, you know, this agent, which is, again, a male-dominated space. So think about how hard you have had to work to get here. So, again, it's like the from the circumstances of the world and the necessary circumstances of the skill, this character started to arise.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like also I hear a connection to improv theater, because what you were just talking about, the script that you write, you are, in a sense, what we'd say in improv is endowing a character off stage, or in this circumstance, you're endowing the person who is interacting with the Alexa skill as being a made up character themselves. So now they're this agent as well that might be able to help hack the system. Yeah, I think that's cool.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, as a improv performer, I'm a member of a group called Improv Playhouse of San Francisco, and we do fully improvised full-length plays. So we're not doing, sometimes we do short form, but for the most part, we do full-length plays, and we know nothing before. Like, we don't know who our characters are going to be, what our relationships are going to be. We don't even talk about who's going to enter first. And what's interesting is that I have my moment before I enter where I have like a moment to engage my logic brain, where if I'm not the first to enter, I might be watching a scene and think, well, what's the kind of dynamic that's happening? What are the energies? What does the scene need? Or what's a contrasting energy I could bring on? But then once I'm on stage, I have to not think with my logic brain, let that kind of operate in the background and just be fully present and immersed and with that like super creative brain forward. And I find, for that reason, I find improv to be like terrifying and thrilling, because I can't engage that analytical, logical part of my brain so much. I really have to let that go.
Yeah.
And whereas I'd say for most of the time, I'm pretty logical with my creative brain always churning in the background, that kind of inverts it, where I have to be super creative and in the moment with the logic churning in the background. But if you watch a bunch of people try to be logical about an improv show, it's going to be terrible.
Right. Yeah.
You want the immediacy, you want the impulsivity, you want the unexpected moments to happen.
As a beginning improviser myself, I have, one of the things that I found myself, kind of a trap that I fall into, and I've seen other beginning improvisers do so, is because you can't plan, you kind of fall into very trivial kind of like stereotypes or tropes, and sometimes the characters don't have this dynamic, fully fleshed out, authentic nature. I'm wondering, in whether improv or scripted theater, what are some characters that you've played that felt like just fascinating characters, or like they really came to life in a way that didn't feel just like a stock character?
Sure. One of my, and to kind of tie this all in up in a neat bow, this whole conversation, my favorite role I think that I've ever had was a play written by my friend Lauren Gunderson, of whom we spoke, and the role was a real woman, Ada Lovelace, who called herself a poetical mathematician, and her father was the poet Lord Byron, and her mother hated her father and didn't, and was so adamant that Ada would not be an artist that she made Ada study math. And it turned out that Ada was a brilliant mathematician, but then Ada's whole brilliance was her artistic brain and her mathematical capabilities. And because of that, she was the very first person to come up with the idea that a computing machine might be something that you could program. So she was the world's first computer programmer. She worked with a man named Charles Babbage, and Alan Turing, all of his work with the Turing machine was all based on the work of Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace.
Oh, wow.
So playing that role in that show written by that woman, and just kind of like all these, it's a phenomenal play. And Ada herself was such an interesting person because she was so full of contradictions and complications, that role in particular stands out. I mean, the most interesting characters are the ones that are complex and contradictory. Or another one of my favorite roles, also written by Lauren Gunderson, from a play called The Taming, in which a Miss America contestant, Miss Georgia, who has a constitutional law degree, decides it's time to reframe the Constitution and kidnaps a Republican senator's aide and a hipster liberal blogger, and locks them all in a hotel room together to reframe the Constitution. And so that was such a fun role because this, talk about a woman of contradictions. She's this Southern belle beauty pageant queen who's got a constitutional law degree and some serious knowledge about not only history, but the current state of the country and the Constitution. And it's just absolutely delicious, like such a fun role.
That's such a fun role.
And I'm still learning in terms of in my improv work. I mean, improv is one of those practices that you're never done learning. You know, you're always growing, you're always learning. And one of the things is to remind yourself about when you're playing a character is that people always want things. People always want things and always need things. Whether you're walking into a room because you need to pee, so you need to just pass through to go to the bathroom, or whether you're walking into a room because your ex is in there and you need to show off and feel, you know, good about yourself. People always want things and always need things. And we're always contradictory. We often want things that are bad for us, or don't want things that are good for us, or want contradictory things. You know, people who love their spouse and want to be married, but also want to have an affair. You know, like we do weird, and that is like what it is to be human. So it's trying to find those contradictions that feel really true and really rooted in a person that kind of bring a character to life. I have yet to create an improv show character that's as brilliantly nuanced as anything that Lauren has ever written.
Right.
But like, that's the dream.
Yeah.
Working towards that.
I love this idea of contradictions. And I had a guest on the show recently, Latif Nasser, who's a director of research at Radiolab.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I asked him about what defines a Radiolab story. And one of the things he talked about was, a Radiolab story is a story which like pulls your head in one direction and your heart in the other.
Yeah.
And
I love Radiolab.
It's so good. And just hearing your last answer to that question reminded me of that answer and kind of I had flashes of characters who I've just thought were fascinating, and it's kind of does that. Yes. It's this contradiction that pulls head in one direction, heart in another.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
And that's what we're always all doing. I mean, it's even when we do it so often that we don't even know that we're doing it. Think about how many moments in your day where you have an impulse. It might be you wake up, it's a beautiful sunny day, and you think, oh, I really want to go to the beach, but you get up and you go to work. So that is happening a million times a day so often that we don't even notice it. There's this constant tug of war and push and pull, and we're constantly, every moment, evaluating what's best for us right now in this moment. And we're so adept at it that it's invisible often, unless it is dramatized and, you know, we really pull it up and make it really big and point to those places. Mm-hmm. But the reason why we identify with it as an audience member so much is that we understand it on a molecular level, because it is our existence.
Mm. It's making clear like those unconscious things that we just feel, but we can't really express.
Yeah.
You were mentioning before we started the show that you started doing improv theater relatively recently. And there are a lot of, as someone who teaches improv, there are a lot of kind of like principles or tenets or like little phrases that kind of capture what the improv spirit is all about. And I'm wondering since you began performing improv, if any of those tenets or principles or just like sayings about improv and how to do improv, any of those have really resonated with you, and that you try to remind yourself, whether you're crafting stories as a conversation designer, as a playwright, or just something that unlocks creativity for you.
One of the biggest gifts of starting improv in general, but with this group of people in particular, has been really inviting play into my life in a really deep way. When I started working with this improv group, it came along kind of at a perfect time in my life where I was getting really burned out after over a decade of doing scripted shows where, like I mentioned, it's like 8 shows a week and rehearsals are brutal and it's really a lot of time and energy and heart. And so I had been getting burnt out on my career, but I always also had a series of like tragic life events that happened. And I came to a point where I just needed a big change, where I didn't feel like I had as much of myself to give unto an audience. And then improv came along, which was such a gift because the sense of play is so deep that I can be having a horrifically bad time going through some deep grief and turmoil, but I go to a show or I go to a workout and all I do is engage in deep play. And I have had shows where I've had more than one show, actually, where I've been in the middle of miscarrying a pregnancy and just being in such a dark place with that and thinking, oh God, I don't want to go do this show. I don't want to be seen. But I tell myself, I'm like, you will feel better afterwards. And so I walk in feeling like crap and I engage in this deep present play. It's like a very Zen thing to be doing improv because you have to be in the moment. And by God, at the end, I always feel exhilarated and connected, a deep sense of connection to the people I'm playing with, but also the people for whom I was playing, because you begin to play with the audience as well. So inviting deep play into my life, but also I mentioned this briefly before, how present you have to be in that work. So a sense of play and deep presentness also just kind of infused into my life, like into my marriage. My husband and I joke and are present and playful with each other. We always have, but even more so now. And in terms of a collaborative spirit as well, like when you're working with improvisers, you have to feel safe and you have to not only feel safe, but you also have to communicate safety to those that you're working with, that they can make bold choices or take big risks and you're going to be there. That absolutely infuses into other work life, where when I'm working with a team on a project, I'm making sure that I'm getting set up so that I can take big risks, but also asking myself, how can I support my collaborators so that they can take big risks and do cool stuff or do vulnerable things or whatever, so that, yeah, that sense of collaboration, play, and in the momentness.
Yeah. I often tell people when I come in to do improv workshops at companies that, you know, I'm kind of just someone who comes in and gives people permission to play. That's one of my most significant roles.
100%. Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, you have a desk over here where you have tons of post-it notes up and looks like a space where you spend a lot of time being creative. And it looked, you were walking me through some of those earlier around the conversation design work you're doing. So for you in that setting, when you're here at your apartment, or this could also be advice to anyone out there who's a storyteller, you know, where you're kind of in solitude. That's kind of like how I feel right now doing this edit on this big documentary, or someone who's writing a novel at their desk. What are ways that you think we can bring more play into our lives to enhance our creativity in those settings, if you're not in like this this like playful improv troupe?
Well, it's a very apt question because I do work remote. I work from home, so I am here by myself. However, I'm lucky to have incredible colleagues that we hop on the phone, we talk through things. But in terms of like bringing a sense of play to your own solitary work, I mean, I think part of it is allowing yourself to go on tangents when you need them. So even if you're working towards a very definitive goal, but you have an impulse, you have a creative impulse, if the deadline isn't 10 minutes from now or whatever, if you're not under the gun, letting yourself follow that impulse and explore that, even if it doesn't result in something that gets put into that project, it might be a seed that starts something later. Or it's like, this is another, and one of the things about play and being present and improv is I've used the word impulse a lot. Like you learn to trust and follow impulses and allow a certain amount of impulsivity, which is inherent to play. When you are really playing, the reality of what you're playing can shift immediately, or you get bored, so you start doing something else. And allowing those impulses, the thing about being an adult, and one of the reasons why we forget to play, is because we get so accustomed to keeping our impulses out of our lives that we forget to listen to them sometimes. So yeah, like going down a garden path if you need to when you're ideating, or taking a break or taking a walk when you need to. But I'm trying to think of how I invite play when it's literally just me. And I'm not on the phone, and I'm not, you know, dragging my husband in the room to be like, can I walk you through this? part of it is, this is silly, but my post-its are all neon colors.
There you go.
And they also, the stacks of the post-it notes are stacked by color, and just kind of creating an environment which is playful and fun for me and visually stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
I have to stop multiple times a day to take this little dog sitting next to me out. and I mean, animals and dogs in particular are like the best clowns because they're so present and ridiculous and just driven by their own impulses. Mm-hmm. They have no filter because they're a dog or a squirrel or whatever, you know, they're great. And it's interesting. I can tell I've been working too hard when I get angry or frustrated at my dog because she needs to go out, because she needs to get fed, because she needs attention. If I'm getting frustrated with her, it's like, I'm too kind of locked in the zone. I need to take a breath. And there are times where like maybe for a day or two, you have to get really, put blinders on and get really into it. But in terms of a productive career or process, you have to be, you can't be so locked in that the everyday pleasures or interactions or like sweet snuggles from a dog become a negative intrusion.
This is one of the areas where I think I reflect a lot on my background as a soccer player, as an athlete. because like, especially when I played soccer at Stanford, and no matter how good the team is, no matter how good I was getting as an individual soccer player, at the beginning of every preseason, it was like back to the fundamentals. Those preseasons weren't necessarily play or fun, but the link I draw is now myself as a filmmaker. The reason that I started making videos was to make like ridiculous music videos with my friends as, you know, middle school and high school and stuff like that. And I think it's very easy when you start to get some sort of accolades or kind of feel fancy and feel like you're getting good that like you're above that, or now everything that you're working on has to be shooting for this super high standard. And I have found that in this more artistic world that I'm now diving into, there isn't the same quite focus on like, you have to go back to the fundamentals, go back to the fundamentals, do your layup lines as a basketball player and stuff like that. And so for me, thinking about how to bring play into my life as a storyteller, when I'm just kind of working in solitude, it's like, give myself like a day on the weekend to go back and make that ridiculous music video that I did with my friends, because that was coming out of a place that was just purely for joy. And also I was like, it's a way to practice skills.
Yeah. This makes it so that the grad school I went to is called the Del Arte International School of Physical Theater. And it was founded by a man named Carlo Mazzone Clemente. And they, and we had these series of exercises we would do that were called the showers. And they were all very basic, fundamental, acting exercises. And the reason why they were called the showers was because Carlo, created them and called them that because he said, you're never too advanced to do a basic exercise. Like, you're never too clean to take another shower. And it's not like you took a shower last week, so you're good now.
Yeah.
You always have to take another shower.
Right.
And so thinking about that mindset as well. And that's one of the reasons why, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think these improvisers I work with are so brilliant, and why I love, playing with them also, is that, and why I love the company Xandra that I do conversation design with, is that it's not about resting on your laurels. It's always about investing in the process, mm-hmm. and seeing what new and exciting things can come out of investing in the process. So either you invest so much in the process and you make your process a practice, something mm-hmm. that you come to again and again, and whether that evolves into a whole new form and expression that nobody ever expected, or it just creates an evolution of a certain form that you've already been working on so that it continues to grow. Like, either one of those, or both, or something entirely different is so cool. But that only comes from a deep examination of the process and a desire to engage in a practice mm-hmm. and be process oriented rather than product oriented. And in fact, with the improv group, one of my favorite things that Tim Orr, our artistic director, says sometimes before the show starts, he goes, okay, have fun. Doesn't have to be a good show. mm-hmm. So like right before we go on stage thinking, oh, the show doesn't have to be good. We just have to go out there, listen to each other, but taking off that product delivery, pressure, and just yeah. really letting it be in the moment.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned that you also have taught a lot in the past, and maybe as a question to kind of wrap up the main show, you could teach the audience on, I guess I just kind of want to ask like how to be better storytellers. And this, I know that's a really broad question, but if there's anything that comes to mind based on what you've seen as a teacher, that's an unlock for people.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things about being, there's two things immediately came to mind about being a better storyteller, teaching yourself how to be a better storyteller. One is to become a student of humanity and to learn, whether it's through history or philosophy. I think I think most things come back to philosophy, but trying to learn as much as you can about humanity and the human experience so that you start to see patterns emerge and you start to have an understanding for who we are and why we do what we do. And that starts to get at some really deep truths so that when you're telling your stories, you start to tap into something that is essentially human rather than like just some cool idea you had. It doesn't matter how awesome you've thought of this plot structure that you thought of, if you're not tapping into something that is a universal human truth that your audience can hook into to come along on the story. It's the reason, like, brilliant storytellers who are really tapping into that are the reason why I can watch a movie like Heat, which is about, you know, people shooting each other, and get which is something that on its surface I'm like, I'm not really interested in that. But I can watch that movie and become so compelled by the story and the characters and the performances because there is something happening there that is so, that is teaching me something about my own humanity. So A, become a student of humanity. And I recommend also like checking out philosophy and trying to identify what these things are that make us human. A, so, you know, just that. No big. And then the other one would be examining stories that you love and trying to take them apart and put them back together and see how they work. So whether it's watching a movie a million times, I'm one of those people that if there's a movie or a book that I love, I will rewatch it. I will reread it. And I'm not consciously trying to take it apart. I'm just trying to relive it over and over again. But that studying of that piece gets me closer to understanding how it's put together. And even sometimes maybe going, all right, this movie is so brilliant, I'm going to go scene by scene and study it like I'm in a college class. So I'm going to map out what are the scenes, what happens in each scene, and like trying to understand how this story is structured and put together. All of those things, the more you learn about story narrative and how it functions, and the more you learn about human beings and how we work and how we function, then once you have a deep understanding of that, you can start to kind of deconstruct it, do your own thing, or just tell a technically badass story. You don't even have to get crazy and deconstruct. If you can just tell a human story about a complex human, that's amazing.
I love it.
Yeah.
Fantastic advice. All right. So Kat is going to stick around for some post-show questions. And if you want to hear her answer questions like, what is her favorite type of cookie? Or what is a bucket list production that she'd want to be in? You can get access to the private podcast feed by supporting the show on Patreon just for $2 a month. You will get access to post shows with all our guests. And so you can find that at patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. All right. Before we wrap up the main show and head into the post show, Kat, if people want to see you perform, listen to your conversations that you've designed and interact with them themselves, where should they go to find you and your work?
Great. So if they would like to see me perform improv, they can check out my improv group, Improv Playhouse of San Francisco. If they Google that, it'll get you the website, which I think is just improvplayhouseofsanfrancisco.com. I have a website. It's katharinezidan.com, katharinezidan.com, although I've not been updating it regularly. I'm not really on social media. You can find me on Instagram if you want to see pictures of my dog. Mm-hmm. And that's Kat_Zidan on Instagram. I have a blog, which is about grief and emotions and is sometimes very funny. And it's called cantnotcry.com. If you would like to play my Alexa skill that has just launched, then you can say to any Alexa device, including the Alexa app on your phone, you can say, Alexa, Open the Division Network. And you will have to give permissions because it's got a mature content rating.
Oh.
But you can do that all with voice. But so yeah, it's Alexa, Open the Division Network. And that will get you into the skill that I just made. And gosh, I tweet so rarely that that's probably not even worth mentioning. So.
All right. Well, they have some options
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Kat. I really appreciate you joining the show.
My pleasure.
That's it for episode 19 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Kat Sedan for joining the show. If you're in the Bay Area, Kat is performing with Improv Playhouse on April 6th in San Francisco. And I can't recommend that troupe strong enough. So check them out if you get a chance. As I mentioned, if you want to hear the post show with Kat and all our future guests, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms for just $2 a month. You'll get access to a private podcast feed, which will play in your native podcast app. Post shows, additional episodes, they're all coming there. And your support goes directly to helping fund the production of the podcast. In this week's post show, Kat talks about moments in her past that at the time felt like apparent failures, but now upon reflection, really she considers gifts. So here's a little taste.
So when one is a professional actor, you get a chance to see this all the time because most of the things you audition for, you do not get cast in. So imagine if you went on 3 to 6 job interviews a month and you got maybe one sometimes, but sometimes none of those came through. I have gotten many opportunities to practice letting go of something that you didn't get and being able to look back and appreciate the fruit that bore out from not getting that opportunity. One of those, actually, I'm thinking of two things in particular. One is kind of light and fluffy and one is a little more intense.
So to check that post show out, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. Our theme music today is by Opus Orange. Shout out to them. And shout out to anyone who's listening and who lives in Palm Springs. I am coming your way at the end of the month to screen my short documentary called The Carpenter at the American Documentary Film Festival. My first film festival. I'm very excited about it. So send me a message on social at Austin Meyer Films if you are out there, because it'd be fun to meet. And even if you're not out there, send me a message at Austin Meyer Films, Instagram, Facebook, all over the place. Let me know how you're enjoying the show. I'd love to hear some feedback from you all. And if you care to do so, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. That would really help. That's it from me. I'll see you next time on the Austin Meyer Podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.